Saving battery first.
If everyone could take your seats, please. Thank you.
There we go.
Well, I will go ahead and introduce our next speaker while this is warming up. It was out for lunch too, apparently, so it's getting there. So people are going to be starting to trickle in. I know how hard it is to come in out of that gorgeous sunshine. But I also feel like we want to get started. So I'm really delighted that Fritjof Capra can be with us and be here with us today. And he, as most of you know, he's a physicist and systems theorist, and he's also the founding director of the Center for Eco-Literacy here in Berkeley, California. And the center advocates for sustainability, and its most recent book, which was, I hope you all got to take a look at, is on the growing movement in K through 12 schools, entitled Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability. And Fritjof is also on the faculty of Schumacher College and an international center for ecological studies in England, and frequently gives management seminars to top executives in North and South America, Europe, and Asia. He's also the author of many international bestsellers. And as I was just telling him that the first that I assume many of you all have also read is called The Tao of Physics. And I was a journalist in India right after I graduated from college, and I found this in one of those old book stalls in Delhi. And it turned my world around. And I remember having these intense, you know, conversations with my father, you know, about how, you know, the veracity of Fritjof's articulation and, you know, the inherent paradoxes in physics and all of this. And but it really allowed me to kind of open my world up, having been trained in a very linear fashion. And so I know that you've broadened my perception and understanding of that of many others, many, many thousands of others. He's also the author of The Turning Point, Uncommon Wisdom, The Web of Life, The Hidden Connections, and he co-authored Green Politics, Belonging to the Universe, Eco-Management, and co-edited Steering Business Towards Sustainability. His most recent book, The Science of Leonardo, was published and is now in paperback as of a couple years ago, and I gather I hope this is okay to say, he's diving deeper into the science of Leonardo and working on a second book in that arena. So I'll only add that I really haven't come across someone who is as brilliant in articulating systems thinking as Fritjof, and I just delight to welcome you here today.
Hello. Thank you, Elise, for this very kind introduction. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a great pleasure for me to share this podium with so many distinguished speakers in this very important symposium. As we have heard this morning, the opportunity for children to live in a healthy environment and to engage directly with nature is a critical factor in their health. I will be speaking about the same issues, but looking at them through a slightly different lens, the lens of ecological sustainability within the context of education. But you will hear many of the same themes discussed again from a different perspective, which is, of course, a tribute to the organizers of the symposium, who invited the speakers in such a way that their themes interweave. We have seen this already this morning, and this is, of course, very important. Well, as you know, one of the great challenges of our time is to build and nurture sustainable communities, that is, social, cultural, and physical environments in which we can satisfy our needs and aspirations without diminishing the chances of future generations. At the Center for Ecoliteracy, we spent the last 20 years or so developing a special pedagogy for teaching the knowledge and skills that are necessary to build sustainable communities in schools. We call it Schooling for Sustainability. It is a pedagogy that offers an experiential, participatory, and multidisciplinary approach. Now, we are sometimes asked, why all these complexities? Why don't you just teach ecology? Well, I would like to show you today that the complexities and subtleties of our approach are inherent in any true understanding of ecology and sustainability. It is not a simple field, not a simple issue. As you may know, the concept of ecological sustainability was introduced by Lester Brown, the founder of the World Watch Institute, in the early 1980s. And since then, it has often been distorted, co-opted, and even trivialized by being used without its proper ecological context. So I think it is worthwhile to reflect for a moment on what sustainability really means. What is sustained in a sustainable community is not economic growth or competitive advantage or any of these things, but rather the entire web of life on which our long-term survival depends. In other words, a sustainable community is designed in such a way that its ways of life, businesses, economy, physical structures, and technologies do not interfere with nature's inherent ability to sustain life. Even more, we need to cooperate with nature to take nature as a model and a mentor. And this is now being done in the new disciplines of ecological design, biomimicry, and so on. There is a lot of creativity going into these new disciplines, as Richard already emphasized before. So creating sustainable communities and nurturing them is not a static state. It's a dynamic, creative process of ongoing cooperation and co-evolution with nature. Well, the first step in this endeavor, naturally, must be to understand how nature sustains life. It turns out that this involves a new ecological understanding of life, as well as a new kind of thinking, thinking in terms of relationships, patterns, and context, thinking that is also known as systemic thinking or systems thinking. And indeed, such a new understanding of life has emerged over the last 30 years or so. At the forefront of contemporary science, the universe is no longer seen as a machine composed of elementary building blocks. We have discovered that the material world ultimately is a network of inseparable patterns of relationships. That the planet as a whole is a living, self-regulating system. Correspondingly, the view of the human body as a machine and of the mind as a separate entity is being replaced by one that sees not only the brain, but also the immune system, the bodily tissues, and even each cell as a living cognitive system. Something that you all know very well from your practice. Evolution is no longer seen as a competitive struggle for existence, but rather as a cooperative dance in which creativity and the constant emergence of novelty are the driving forces. And with the new emphasis on complexity, networks, and patterns of organization, a new science of qualities is now slowly emerging. Now, to go into the details of this new scientific understanding of life would take up at least the rest of this day. So I can only concentrate on a few highlights. And to illustrate the very essence of this new understanding of life, let me just ask the age-old question, what is life? Well, in a scientific context, we would ask, what are the defining characteristics of a living system? In other words, what's the difference between a rock and a plant or animal or microorganism? Now, if you go and ask biologists, then many will tell you, for example, that living organisms are made of cells. Rocks are not made of cells. That's a key characteristic. And within the cells, there are so-called macromolecules, long chains of atoms and molecules based on carbon. And at the center is, the nucleus of the cell, the DNA. And many biologists would just say, well, it's actually not so difficult to define a living organism. It's a chemical system that contains DNA. So all you have to do is look for the DNA and you will know whether it's alive or not. Well, the problem with this definition is that when an organism dies, the DNA does not disappear. It is just a molecule. So in this wood here, all the DNA that was in the tree is still in there. So in order to really have a more accurate definition of biological life, you would have to say a living system is a chemical system that contains DNA and which is not dead. And that, of course, is not a definition. It's a tautology. Well, I'm taking you through this little exercise to show you that the essential difference between a living and a non-living system lies not in the context, but in the process of life, in what sages and poets throughout the ages have called the breath of life. In modern scientific language, this process is called metabolism. Metabolism is the ceaseless flow of energy and matter through a network of chemical reactions which enables a living organism to continually generate, repair, and perpetuate itself. In other words, metabolism involves the intake, digestion, and transformation of food. So metabolism is the central characteristic of biological life. To illustrate this, let's begin with single-celled organisms like bacteria. In those single cells, there's a cell membrane surrounding the cell which controls the organism's intake and nutrients and excretion of waste. So by keeping certain substances out and letting other substances in, the cell membrane regulates the cell's molecular identity. This means that cellular identity is shaped and sustained by the intake of food. Moving on to multicellular organisms, you will remember that they are classified according to the methods of acquiring nutrients. They're classified into different kingdoms. So aside from the microorganisms, the bacteria, we have the kingdom of plants. Plants photosynthesize. Fungi secrete enzymes, digest the food outside their bodies, and then ingest the processed food. And of course, animals, including ourselves, ingest our food and then digest it. So in each case, the manner of taking in food defines an organism as a member of one of three kingdoms, plants, fungi, or animals. These are all different varieties of metabolism. And because of this essential connection between food and metabolism, between food and the central characteristic of life, food is an ideal entry point for teaching ecology in schools. At the Center for Ecoliteracy, we have found that reconnecting children to the fundamentals of food reconnects them to the fundamentals of life. And we've also found that this is the ideal way to teach them about culture, health, and the environment. Now, returning for a moment to metabolism, there are two basic aspects. One is the continuous flow of energy and matter through a living organism. All living systems need energy and food to sustain themselves, and all living systems produce waste. That's part of metabolism. But life has evolved in such a way that organisms form communities or ecosystems in which the waste of one species is food for the next, so that matter cycles continually through the ecosystem. Well, the second aspect of metabolism is the network of chemical reactions that processes the food and forms the biochemical basis of all biological structures. The emphasis here is on network. One of the most important insights of the new systemic understanding of life is the recognition that networks are the basic pattern of organization of all living systems. As you know, ecosystems are understood in terms of food webs, that is, networks of organisms. Then organisms are networks of cells, of organs, of organ systems, and cells are networks of molecules. So the network is a pattern that is common to all life. Wherever we see life, we see networks. Now, it's also important to realize that you shouldn't take this phrase literally, wherever we see networks, because most of these networks can actually not be seen because they're not anatomical structures. They are what we call functional networks, patterns that interlink certain life processes in network fashion. For example, in a cell, all the biological structures, the relatively large structures, the proteins, enzymes, the DNA, and so on, are continually produced, repaired, and regenerated by the cellular network. Similarly, at the level of a multicellular organism, the bodily cells are continually regenerated and recycled by the organism's metabolic network. So living networks continually create or recreate themselves by transforming or replacing their components. Now, the detailed theory of these living self-generating networks is too technical to be taught in schools. Some of you may have heard the terms autopoiesis, dissipative structures, and so on. These are recent scientific theories. We cannot immediately transfer this into a school curriculum. But what we can teach, and what we do teach in our ecoliteracy schools, is that one of the key characteristics of living networks is the fact that all their nutrients are passed along in cycles. So now you have two concepts, networks and cycles. In an ecosystem, energy flows through the network, while water, oxygen, carbon, and all the nutrients of the ecosystem move in these well-known ecological cycles. Similarly, the blood cycles through our body, and so does the air, the lymph fluid, and so on. So wherever we see life, we see networks, and wherever we see living networks, we observe cyclical flows. This is an essential part of the new systemic understanding of life that has emerged in science over the last 30 years or so, and this is why we emphasize the web of life, the flows of energy, and the cycles of nature in our pedagogy. At the Center for Ecoliteracy, we have found that growing a school garden and using it as a resource for cooking school meals are an ideal way of experiencing these concepts, the web of life, the flows of energy, and the cycles of nature. Gardening reconnects children to the fundamentals of food and thus to the fundamentals of life, while integrating and enlivening virtually every activity that takes place in a school. The understanding of life in terms of networks, flows, and cycles is relatively new in science. But it is an essential part of the wisdom of spiritual traditions. And it is not a coincidence that gardening and preparing food from what grows in the garden have been integral parts of religious practice in many spiritual traditions, in Christian monasteries, in Buddhist monasteries, and so on. Interestingly, gardening and cooking are examples of what you could call cyclical work, work that has to be done over and over again, work that does not leave any lasting traces. You cook a meal and it's immediately eaten. You clean the dishes, but they will soon be dirty again. You plant, tend the garden, harvest, and then plant again. Now, in our society, this cyclical work that leaves no traces is not very highly valued, as you know. What is highly valued is to leave something big, a big building, a big structure, or even doing paperwork that contributes to this big structure. On the other hand, this cyclical work is part of monastic practice or spiritual practice because it helps us recognize the natural order of growth and decay, of birth and death, and in this way makes us aware of how we are all embedded in those cycles of nature. In the garden, we learn about food cycles, and we integrate the natural food cycles into our cycles of planting, growing, harvesting, composting, and recycling. Through this practice, we also learn that the garden as a whole is embedded in larger systems that, again, are living networks with their own cycles. So the food cycles intersect with these larger cycles, the water cycle, the cycle of the seasons, and so on, all of which are links in the planetary web of life. In the garden, we also learn that a fertile soil is a living soil, containing billions of living organisms in every cubic centimeter. These soil bacteria carry out various chemical transformations that are essential to sustaining life on Earth. Because of the basic nature of the living soil, we need to preserve the integrity of the great ecological cycles in our practice of gardening and agriculture. Now, these principles are embodied in traditional farming methods, which are based on a profound respect for life. The school garden is the ideal place to teach the merits of organic farming to our children. Through gardening, we also become aware how we ourselves are part of the web of life. And over time, the experience of ecology in nature gives us a sense of place. We become aware of how we are embedded in an ecosystem, in a landscape with a particular flora and fauna, in a particular social system and culture. For children, being in the garden is something magical. As one of our teachers put it, one of the most exciting things about the garden is that we are creating a magical childhood place for children who would not have such a place otherwise, who would not be in touch with the earth and the things that grow. You can teach all you want, but being out there, growing and cooking and eating, that's an ecology that touches their heart and will make it important to them. And like Richard before me, I can testify to this from a personal perspective. I grew up on a farm in Austria, and I spent the first 10 years of my childhood, you know, running around barefoot all summer long. And, you know, we had our own little beds of tomatoes and radishes and so on. We were several kids. And that farm is still with me. I still treasure that memory. That doesn't leave you. And so what we create by encouraging children to go out into nature and by educating them in nature is something that will stay with them and will make them responsible citizens of the earth. Thank you very much for your attention.